Ruth Stevens, I want to get personal.
Oh. And you can see I'm still in my nightgown.
I love it.
Nightgown and t-shirt. This is my COVID uniform.
Well, the important part is the brain.
Indeed.
Yeah. And I do want to talk a little bit about literally the face we put forward to the world with B2B marketing as a company. And so we're going to stick a pin in that one.
Okay.
I want to get down to business and then I want to talk tactics. All right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Wonderful. I think you're the woman for the job.
Thank you.
So starting with the personal, a big aspect of what I personally try to do with Moss Appeal and any of these kinds of interviews, their whole raison d'être, I don't think I said that right, is to humanize the executive or the guest. I think that's a core part of B2B marketing. People buy from people they like or they trust. I want to really share a little bit more of the personal of you. What is the Ruth Stevens brand, let's say?
I identify myself as a consultant and educator in B2B marketing, and I've been self-employed for 21 years and so happy in that role. And in the last 10 years or so, developed a side gig of traveling to interesting foreign cities and teaching for a semester or a half a semester in a top business school there. So I've created for myself, using marketing and education as a vehicle, a daily life to think of new opportunities, meet new people, develop new ideas, and just feel stimulated, satisfied, and also contributing something every day. I'm so lucky.
Well, that's a great little lifestyle right there. Well, it was up until March of 2020, mm-hmm. I'm guessing.
I've been grounded.
Yeah, along the lines were clipped. Well, we're going to get into all of that and how B2B can be personal, how we can get down to business and leverage B2B, and then some specifics from your lesson plans, whether it's here in New York or in Hong Kong and various places you've taught.
Thanks.
Hey, it's E.B. Moss, and this is episode 35 of Insider Interviews about Media, Marketing, and Advertising. And today, Ruth Stevens is the one who's going to give us the insider scoop, this time on B2B marketing. Ruth is something of an expert. She's been named one of the most influential people in the space and one of 20 women to watch. And she also teaches marketing at B schools like Columbia and NYU Stern. So I think we're going to get some really good lessons from her. You can also read some of Ruth's thought leadership at Biznology, AdAge, HBR.org, and a bunch of other places. But right now, we're going to get it directly from Ruth, the former president of the Direct Marketing Club of New York, right here for episode 35 of Insider Interviews. Well, Ruth Stevens, I've known you for a few years now, and it's always been my pleasure, but I always feel like I just want to sit at your feet and learn from you. So,
really?
So, yes.
I feel the same way about you.
Oh, thank you. Well, it's a little love fest here, but let's share a little bit of the why I feel that way by telling us a little bit of your background. You went from Time Warner to IBM to RuthStevens.com. How'd you do that?
I was so lucky to be hired out of business school into Time Warner, the Book of the Month Club division. And I went there thinking that I was joining one of the great book marketing companies in the world. And I learned on the first day that I was actually in one of the great direct marketing companies in the world. And fortunately, I took to direct marketing immediately. I loved how it requires creativity in terms of developing customer insight and coming up with ideas for better offers, better media strategies. I was in charge of member acquisition for the special interest book clubs there for several years. And I loved that creative side, but I also loved how our deliverables were so tangible that I was buying media based on projected ROI of the buy, based on actual numbers of similar members who came from that media outlet in the past. And I could explain to management and to the media seller, for example, and anybody else, why I was making the decisions I was and what were the payoffs. We could really demonstrate the ROI of our marketing investments and didn't have to squabble over creative or offer or target audience decisions the way many marketers are forced to do because they don't have the data at hand. So I just loved it. And I stayed at Time Warner for 7 years until I was offered an opportunity at Ziff Davis. They had so many business units. Bill Ziff was a genius at strategizing target audiences that were willing to buy expensive stuff that he could then advertise. So it was just an editorial gold mine. And he built an ad sales machine. I arrived when it was just growing like crazy. And this was my first exposure to B2B and how decision-making is so different in business versus households about what to buy. And I just loved that from day one. And I was in charge there of generating leads for a phone-based sales force that was selling a CD-ROM annual subscription monthly CDs in the mail.
I probably have Time Warner books on my shelf and CD-ROMs next to those. And I blame you for filling up my shelves.
We can play the CD-ROMs anymore, but it was a great era. So after Ziff, I moved to IBM for about 3 years, and I was generating sales leads for the various business units in North America, hardware, software, services. So that was a great experience. I learned a lot.
You were a thinker-doer, as they say. You had the creative and the data from Time Warner in B2C. You had the B2B aspect. You had the hardware and tech business marketing from IBM. So you were a triple threat. And so you taught all of that?
I actually started teaching at night when I was at IBM in the NYU professional and continuing ed program. And I really enjoyed it. So when I went out on my own and asked if they could give me more classes, they became really my top client in my first year as a self-employed person. But I also called up several of my business friends and said, can you give me any projects to work on? This was in 2000. I had a pal at American Express who gave me a little project that needed a marketing lead. It gave me the opportunity to realize that basically freelance marketing work has some value to corporations. And I was able really within the first 3 to 6 months to determine that I could make a living as a self-employed person. And I just loved it. Boy, the flexibility, the freedom, the avoidance of evildoers.
And today, pants. You were ahead of your time with the nightgown attire. And your writing is prolific. I mentioned in the introduction that you have been published in everything from Ad Age and HBR.org. You've written white papers, 3 books now, I think,
yes,
to your credit.
It's again about who you know and working that network. So I started also writing for the marketing trade press when I was at IBM as well. And when I went out on my own, I called up Ken McGill, who was the editor of iMarketing News and for whom I'd been writing a monthly column. And I said, Ken, do you ever pay your columnists? The next day, I guess he talked to Ray Schultz and offered me $400 for my monthly columns. I was on my way as a paid columnist. And writing actually became an important revenue stream for me as a consultant and educator. And I've made a pretty good living using those multiple lines of revenue ever since.
Yeah, it's awesome. And now one part of your brand and one aspect that, again, back to the personal, I really appreciate is that you are fairly clear that BS has no place in B2B.
Can I use that? What a great yes, title you may. For an article.
And that will be $400. But you, speaking of great titles, you teed me up perfectly because I was going to talk about an article you wrote a few months ago with the simple headline of "Don't be a jerk on LinkedIn."
I love that.
So
it is an attention-getting headline.
Yes. Yeah. Let's talk about the personal aspects of B2B. As I also said in the beginning, we have to humanize ourselves if we're going to engender trust. And we want to sell. We really want to sell on LinkedIn. But how do we come across like we're not selling?
Right. It's a really interesting conundrum because it's reminiscent of the personal business relationship we have in face-to-face environments. When we go to networking events or any business events, we want to get to know people and we want to establish a relationship with them. And ultimately, we want to do business with them, but we have to establish the personal relationship first. So it's a category that highly favors the extrovert, sadly.
Yeah.
Being an extrovert, I have that an advantage there. But my point is that in social media, it's more subtle that establishing a personal relationship on LinkedIn is harder. You can't go get the person you're chatting with another glass of wine. And you can't really have the kind of chit-chat like, what have you been reading or how many children do you have? Those kinds of personal details, because they seem forced and irrelevant. Mm-hmm. So that's why people, I think, get lazy and go straight to the selling and skip the personal establishment part. And they're also, of course, just sorely tempted by how easy it is to make a mass pitch using LinkedIn Sales Navigator, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And just in the last several months, I don't know about you, EB, but I've been receiving lots of LinkedIn connections from people who want me to try out their LinkedIn sales tool.
Oh, yeah. I can get you leads.
A new thing. Yeah. And I, of course, shy away from that. I personally am very, shall I say, promiscuous in accepting LinkedIn requests because I see the value of a network, but I certainly do not appreciate the sales pitch from people I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's such a balance between sort of the clickbaity version of personal posts, like you said, and then also not selling. And also just being authentic, to use a word that's perhaps overused, but
a good word too. It's a good goal and kind of guiding star for your behavior.
So we've got to find that balance, that authenticity, as we said, but you've also got to have some kind of persona as a business seller. And in your second book, Maximizing Lead Generation, little plug there, I'll add a link to the show notes. You said that the salesperson was in a nifty position to educate and influence back in the day, basically, in the earliest stages of the process. But today, the salesperson has lost control. Buyers don't really want to talk to vendors until somewhere akin to 70% of the way down the road, at the stage of writing RFPs and getting quotes. And by then, the possible solutions and specifications are already set. So we have quite the conundrum. We have to personalize the seller. We have to make people want to come to them and trust them, but they can't really be a hard ass in their selling approach. So what do we do?
Yeah, that's why B2B marketing has become even more interesting in the world of the internet, where buyers are using research as a substitute for calling in a salesperson. And so as the quote you described says, the ability of the salesperson to guide that purchase in his or her direction, but also to understand more deeply what the needs of the buyer are, has been eroded. So the marketer needs to step in and provide the educational content. This has driven the rise of content marketing to allow that researcher to satisfy the need for understanding better how I'm going to solve this problem that I have and how our solution can be helpful and guide them toward calling us. So content marketing is a huge part of the B2B marketing mix today. And that's also why events and now virtual events have taken on an even larger role, because those researchers are using events as a place to get their questions answered. So we need to be even more active at business events than before, and to create our own events and opportunities, webinars and executive meetings, peer group meetings, and other opportunities to build the relationship that you're talking about.
So it's the need to be present, to offer good, trusted content, to be across multiple platforms. So, what a shift. And what about the humans that are buying stuff from us? How do we consider them in our marketing?
It's really still a huge challenge because, as you pointed out, the salesperson doesn't know the buyer. The buying groups are getting larger than ever, especially in enterprise purchasing. And the marketers need to try to replicate that relationship building by identifying the members of the buying circle and seeing what we can do to either find out, like through outbound calling, for example, or social listening, or infer what their agendas are, because each member of the buying circle usually has a different agenda, different need, and then serve those needs on a really one-to-one basis. And despite all of our wonderful MarTech and our data, it's really hard to do for the same reasons you were mentioning earlier, EB, where it can sound inauthentic and tinny and ham-handed and every other word that describes failure in a relationship building objective.
And how do we apply best practices from typically consumer marketing to B2B? What do we do about our creative? So we have content that's everywhere. We have informed information, but what kind of form should that content take?
Creative still needs to be about education, but in a context that captures attention and establishes credibility, trust. So it's a really slippery challenge. We stumble when we try to apply consumer creative strategies in B2B because we go for big ideas, we go for humor, we go for poignancy, and there are emotional triggers that can be leveraged in the B2B relationship, but they're not as blatant as they are in consumer. And it takes a real pro to develop a creative environment for a B2B message that will resonate and not seem off.
Oh, so that's really, really interesting. So finding the balance. You still want to have that appeal, but you can't be cloying. You can't be trying too hard. That sounds like you've got to have a really strong brand strategy from the get-go that goes across all divisions and departments.
I think the term brand is misunderstood in B2B. Still, from a salesperson's point of view, the power of the brand is measured by whether it helps the salesperson get a meeting. Is it opening doors for me? When I cold call, do they say, oh, I've heard of you? Or, oh, yeah, somebody was talking about you the other day. That's what they want to hear.
Yeah.
But that kind of brand building is very expensive. I mean, we know this. So content marketing has become the more efficient vehicle for that purpose. We try to produce informative educational content that will step in and be downloaded by random people and allow them to say things like, oh, yes, I've heard of you, when the salesperson calls.
I want to talk a little bit more about how the personal converts to the how-to. We're still human beings. We still want to respond to good marketing. So what is the difference? What should B2B consider or borrow from B2C? And what should they leave on the table?
The questions about messaging in B2B are really fraught, because the fundamental message we want to get across is, we understand you. We are experts in the problem that you have, and you can trust us to help you solve the problem. But how to get that across without saying as much, to create really an emotional connection, which is needed in the human interaction, even though you're buying for business purposes. Creating that trust, creating that perception of expertise, it's difficult to borrow from a traditional consumer creative playbook, because we'll go down a path that will either sound tinny or irrelevant. Like, you know how humor often falls flat in marketing? It falls even flatter in B2B. We can't be as direct in generating emotions like fear and greed that a consumer creative would go for. We have to be more careful. And that means that the creative strategy must rely on, frankly, a lot of experience in the world of business buying. This is why the B2B agency function exists in the world, because they know what they're doing and they can come up with messaging strategies that grab attention and deliver the message in a way that makes sense to the business buyer.
You know, part of what I do in writing what I call explanatory journalism, or doing interviews like this with executives, is the need to communicate factual information in a creative and storytelling way. But what you're saying, and I love the fact that you said you can't rely on greed there and fear, but there can still be a storytelling arc to it. So good B2B creative is possible, but let's say at a toned down level.
Right.
Okay.
And this is why I'm glad you brought up storytelling. That has become the watchword for B2B creative today.
Got it. One of the things that you wrote about in an article that you published recently, and I'll add a link to this, I love this article, was about the pressure and the mistake of companies trying to focus on B2B marketing for sales lead gen only. Let me hear you rant in that Ruth Stevens way.
Thank you.
Listen.
I really did get a lot off my chest in that article. I identified three areas that are a problem, but the one that you're referring to is that the senior management is often asking marketing to focus their metrics and to measure their own contribution primarily on sales results. And lead generation is undoubtedly the number one function of a B2B marketing department. Absolutely. But as we discussed earlier, the marketing team has a much bigger job than simply, and it's not simple, but motivating people to raise their hands and qualifying that interest and handing it over to a salesperson. We know that they need to be stepping in to that 76% of the buying process that is uncovered by sales today. So the problem with asking marketers to base their entire value proposition to the firm on sales results is that unfairly puts the sales piece of the puzzle into the marketer's metrics kit. If the marketers are handing good quality leads and generating interest and building trust and a perception of value in the marketplace, and the sales team can't close the deal, then marketing shouldn't be taking the hit for that, or at least for the part of that that's about closing the business. We need other metrics to help marketers understand what they're delivering and help management assess the value of what they're delivering.
Okay, so give me a couple examples of those metrics, because you also literally wrote the book on database marketing for B2B.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, one metric that marketing can rely on or feel comfortable delivering on is cost per lead, or its cousin, cost per qualified lead.
Ah.
And that's because the marketing department owns and, you know, has responsibility and has the power to improve that and manage it and eke out a better results. The lead to sales conversion rate, that shouldn't be their bailiwick. And then, of course, that all boils down to the definition of qualified as a lead. So it gets complicated. But to that point about building relationships and building awareness, we need an awareness metric or maybe a trust metric that can credit marketing with all of the earlier pre-lead stuff that they should be investing in to be the substitute for cold calling and be the attracting and the establishing of the relationship earlier in the,
beautiful,
in the buying process.
And that ties us all the way back to what we teed up at the beginning, which is that it's about content, it's about being everywhere, it's about how you position that and having a different voice for B2B versus B2C, but still being creative. Okay, it's all coming together. And that feeds into the other point in your article, which is don't forget that so much business still comes from existing clients. So retention has to be a focus of B2B marketing also. So, okay.
Yeah, and that's another area that I see B2B companies failing at or sub-optimizing retention. And it just drives me crazy because this is where the bulk of profits arise. And most companies organize the function to be the responsibility of someone called account management, which is an important function, but marketing is not being asked to support it. And the way to penetrate an account, expand the value of an account, is through both sales touches and marketing touches. So asking your marketing department to solely focus on net new accounts is a huge error and a place where B2B marketers could really gain a lot of value if they shifted those responsibilities a bit.
And again, I'm going to recap because we have to find the balance between brand awareness, because the more familiar you are and the more it's top of mind, that's going to help with retention, and demand marketing or driving the ROI of marketing. And it just so happens that I edit a publication about brand and demand marketing called The Continuum. And there's a lot of good thought leadership in it about balancing that awareness with performance and consumer. So is there a difference in brand and demand when it comes to B2B?
At a theoretical level, at a strategic level, no. It's the same concept.
You need both.
Between B2B and B2C, but down on the ground, of course, we're talking about a very different buying process, which is in B2B, which is why I love B2B. It's more complicated. It's longer. It involves more individuals, all of whom have to be engaged with and influenced. So it's a different animal.
Mm. Well, let's talk about verticals then. Is there a difference in marketing services as a business versus, you know, consumer goods to vendors or distributors?
In this context, no. The big difference is purchases that are made by a single individual versus those that require multiple parties. And an example of the former would be typically e-commerce, mail order, and the business categories might be services, but more likely it would be like replacement parts, office supplies, and other product and service categories that don't require a lot of people involved in the decision. When it comes to raw materials, professional services, technology, other business process-oriented purchasing, manufacturing, those typically involve a large number of people. And so the whole sales and marketing function needs to support that.
Just to wrap it up, and I'll pay homage to your first book, which was about trade event and event marketing. I just got back from my first in-person conference in almost 2 years. Thank you, Podcast Movement. And it was really great to have the chance to see people up close and personal, and then also, you know, put my hands on some products at a booth. I wore gloves the whole time. No, I'm kidding. and meet some of the reps, and I did not shake hands. But that human aspect, again, just circling back. But of course, in your book, and another famous Ruth rant, and I think that should be a new column, is that there were many booths that did not sort of jump off the page at me. I didn't get what they were. Yeah, you're shaking your head. People
because
can't say
I
that.
This book in 2005, and
people pay
making the same mistakes.
So especially with B2B, when you're communicating something complex, we have to be mindful of that. So what's a lesson from, as we hopefully get back into more in-person or event areas, that we can take away from that book?
Yeah, the impetus for writing that book was exactly the story that you're mentioning, where I would be on the show floor walking up and down the aisles and trying to decide which booth to approach and have a conversation with. And the clues that are available to make that selection decision are primarily about the messaging behind the person who's standing there. If the messaging is buzzwords that don't convey a good reason for why I might be interested in having the conversation, they're not going to get me to stop. And then the other big pet peeve that I wrote about was, once I do decide to stop at the booth and I say, "So what do you guys do anyway?" When the rep at the booth did not have a cogent value proposition to explain why I should care and how they're different from their competitors.
The internal training, the practice. So I'm seeing a through line here. And it starts with the very first thing we talked about with your LinkedIn don't be a jerk rant.
Don't be a jerk on the show floor.
Don't be a jerk on the show floor. But it's also the fact that you can't be too lighthearted and do sort of like a clickbaity sign even on a show floor, because there were also booths that were brightly colored and lovely banners, but maybe there was a smiley face that said, "Have a nice day. I don't know what your product is." And right, you can't be too complex and go for the jugular either in your messaging. So again, brand has to come through, but with that story, with that clear message, and with helpful information that's going to draw me in. So that's on the show floor, on social, in personal selling, in our content.
A nice wrap up. That is the theme that has really threaded its way through our conversation today.
Yeah. Well, thank you for this conversation, Ruth Stevens, Professor Stevens. I think you taught us all a few good lessons. And thank you for all that you do and your three books and for ranting. I love it.
Thanks so much, Evie.
Well, I hope you got some good insider scoop from this episode of Insider Interviews with me, E.B. Moss. If you enjoyed this content, please feel free to buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/mossappeal. And I hope you'll follow Insider Interviews on social media and let me know if you have a question or a suggestion for a next stellar guest in media, marketing, and advertising. Speaking of stellar, my theme music was composed and performed by the incomparable Grammy-winning John Clayton. If I can help you with your company's podcast, please find me at mossappeal.com. Thanks again for listening.